This podcast was produced by Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access radio station. Free FM is by the people, for the people. We champion a platform for direct media involvement by the region's diverse communities. We're a non-profit charitable organisation and greatly value donations to support our work. If you could spare a few dollars, please consider making a donation to Free FM at givealittle.co.nz/org/freefm.
This is In Deep with the Leaders, a series of conversations with the mayoral candidates. Over the next hour, we will be exploring their ideas, motivations, and listening to their music as we attempt to delve a little deeper into the hearts and minds of those who would lead our city into the future. I'm Andrew Johnston, and in the studio I have with me mayoral candidate Tim. Now, Tim, I'm going to ask you to pronounce your second name, because I've been looking at it all week, and it's every time I practice it and I say, am I saying it right, to other members of the staff here, they go, no, you're saying it wrong.
It's Wickeriffy.
Wickeriffy.
Yes. And I'm not that worried about people who mispronounce it. You know, I think people can be a little bit... I won't say the A word about things like that, but...
now, Tim, the interesting thing about you is that you are, on one hand, a libertarian, and on the other hand, you're a fundamentalist Christian. Now, that is a very strange juxtaposition. How does that work?
Yeah, I can understand why some people would find that a little bit strange. Personally, I think they fit together perfectly. Obviously, it comes about by what a person believes the Bible is actually saying and what is good politics. And how it basically it comes down to a person's holistic ethics, and I don't believe Christianity is about imposing morality on other people. I believe morality has to come from within as an immoral compass, and that Christianity works by free speech, basically preaching, and if people want to embrace those ethics and take them on board, then they'll choose to live that live by those ethics without legal compulsion. And so I think there's a harmony between libertarianism and Christianity as it's truly supposed to be preached.
Well, that's a good point. The science of neurology and genetics is telling us more and more that morality is a built-in a genetic component of social creatures like ourselves. It's something that helps us live in cooperation with each other and social groupings.
I dispute a lot of the evolutionary biology and interpretations that go on, the materialistic interpretations that we don't have free will and things like that. I believe there's a mixture involved. I believe we are part physical, part spiritual, that yes, there are physical and, you know, the nature, nurture aspect of things, but I also think we have that third component of free will, and that ultimately we are free will moral agents, and therefore we can guide our own lives down whichever path we like. And we can take the high, hard road, or we can take the low road, it's about a person. I think that's the most important thing about an individual is the choices they make, and I do believe they are responsible for their choices, and you can learn by your mistakes and things like that.
What about those of us who carry a mental illness, or those who are born, what neurology, the science of neurology calls a psychosis, those who are psychotic, and they have very little choice. You know, one of the interesting bits of research that's been in the headlines lately is the gene that determines whether you're going to be a murderer or not. And one of the leading researchers in the world himself carries this particular gene.
Yeah.
And his own family has had a series of murderers. You know, there's no free will in that, is there?
I find that a very weak argument. Yes, I do understand that we can have mental illnesses. I do believe, that yes, there are circumstances that can make it harder for individuals to make sensible decisions. I'm not doubting that there is a line of insanity where people might be on the other side of that line and aren't responsible for their choices, but I would be interesting. I'd like to personally interview these people who, you know, these murderers and his family and stuff like that. I don't believe, you know, I can't comment because I don't know the circumstances, but I think it's a cop-out. I think everyone, you know, a lot of these people look for excuses why they do these things, but ultimately, you know, we know, most of us know, and I'm not saying everyone does, most of us know when we're going to do something wrong, and for some weird reason or other, we just choose to bugger it, we're going to do it. Whether we're going to pay the consequences of it, whatever, but we can't say that we didn't know it was wrong. I'm not saying that's true for everybody. I do know that there are mental conditions and people have their highs and lows in life and times of strength and times of weakness. That's part of the human condition. And so, of course, when you have cases of murder and things like that, you hear the case, people present what goes on, and there might be mitigating circumstances that you might take into consideration for culpability and for punishment, you know, and I guess you just take every case on its own merits.
Now, as a Christian, do you believe that your truth is the truth? I think that's one of the New Zealanders are quite a secular people, and one of the things that New Zealanders do not like about religion is that it's claim to truth.
Yeah.
Now we've got within our own local community, we have Muslims, we have Hindus,
yes,
and on a fundamental level, a fundamentalist Muslim and a fundamentalist Hindu and a fundamentalist Buddhist, they would all say, "But my truth is the only truth."
Well, that's interesting because, for several reasons. For starters, my truth changes every day. I'm a person who tries to keep an open mind and tries to learn and to, you know, whether it's just keeping an ear open for what's going on out in the world and in the realm of science and just in discussion, dialogue, and learn from my mistakes and other things like that. So I don't think, you know, no, I don't claim to have the truth in my own head, like a closed box, done deal type thing. And also, when we talk about, like, my Christian belief, I also believe that, and this is important for my libertarian values, in that I actually believe humanity share a core set of values. So I believe that I would share a core set of values with people who are Hindus, Muslims, atheists. You know, there are some fundamentals, like, for example, I want to live safe, I want my children to be safe, and I want to have be able to provide for my own honestly. If we sat down and discussed things, you'd actually find that there was a quite a large consensus of values. And so as a libertarian, as someone who's standing for office and for an activist, I try to appeal. I try to appeal to those common values, which, if we could only realise that they exist, man, I honestly believe they could solve a lot of the world's problems. You know, there's a lot of the problems that are in politics. I don't doubt, like, for example, I'm very adamant against socialism, but I don't mean to say that I don't think socialists intentionally evil people. And I wish that socialists would look at me and realise that though I'm into freedom, that I'm not a evil person. It's about how we go about achieving those common goals and common values. And I do believe that there is one God. I do believe that the Bible is true, but I certainly don't agree with how a lot of people interpret that book. And so, I think you've got to be very careful. That's why I'm a libertarian. I believe in a person's right to follow their own conscience and the dictates, as long as they're peacefully going about it at their own expense and reaping what they sow. I think you've got to have as open and as free a society as possible. And I certainly have no animosity towards peaceful people, no matter what their fundamental beliefs are, because I respect a person's right, and that's what a person has to do, you know.
Now, you're suggesting that socialism is about control. What about the right then? The far right is, we're seeing lately with the GCSB yes. bill, we're seeing, but let's just say while Helen Clark was the Prime Minister, yes. we heard from the right that we heard about Nanny State and Helengrad.
Yes, yes.
Yet we're seeing exactly the same kind of behaviour from a right government that wants to control.
Yes, that's right, because there are the left and the right are both different forms of socialism. National socialism, which was the right, it's still about, fundamentally control and the state, the sovereignty of the state and a dictatorship. And a micromanaging of our lives. So there is no difference. You know, there's a few small differences between Helen Clark and John Key, but basically they believe the same fundamental things, and that is that the government has the right to treat us almost however they please, to take us as much tax money off us as they think they need, et cetera, et cetera. And so, that's why I'm in politics myself as a libertarian, to actually present a complete alternative dynamic to that. And it's difficult to get that message across, because the status quo is being taught across the board. It's in Western civilization, not just in New Zealand. So when you present new ideas, present new ways of achieving goals, and when you observe, we pretty much hear every day Kiwis complaining about the cost of living, jobs, all of the usual complaints. But then when it comes to election time, they keep electing the same types of politicians who haven't got any new ideas, and just keep making excuses why things keep getting worse, why they have to keep passing more laws and taxing us higher, and inflation keeps going up. And when you analyse that as a libertarian, you actually realise that the government is mostly the problem, not the solution, you know.
What is the difference between libertarianism and anarchy?
There's an important difference, and that is anarchists don't believe in a state at all. And many people think libertarians are anarchists, and that's not true. Libertarians believe there is a just limit and sphere for political action and law. And so you've got to ask, this is one of the most fundamental questions, is what is the proper role of government? And libertarians worked out, several hundred years ago, that the only legitimate spheres for government intervention and action is the defence of our rights from force or fraud, either internal or domestic force or fraud, or from external threats, So as a libertarian, I believe we could implement a series of reforms and reduce the scale of our government right down, so that we basically, ultimately, and it's quite a long road to get there, but ultimately to just the police force, the army, and the court system, and everything else could be done via voluntary associations and free enterprise. And what that does is it keeps government in check. It reduces its powers. And B, it opens up the sphere for private free action innovation. For example, when I wrote my little speech for the mayoralty, I was careful to explain that and try to put across in only 150 words that if Hamilton is going to become a great city, it's not the mayor who's going to make it a great city, it's the people who are going to make it a great city, as long as they are free, left free and unimpinged, and take on the responsibility themselves to make the city great. It's not looking to a great leader, like looking to an Adolf Hitler or whatever, that's ridiculous, you know. The best, like I tried to explain it, that the best thing as mayor I could do is keep the council small and focused on its core infrastructural responsibilities, A, so that it does those things well, and B, doesn't explode in debt and rates, so it keeps the debt and rates under control, and C, allows Hamiltonians to invent their city, to create their city, and to achieve their goals and ambitions, you know.
When we leave things entirely to private enterprise, we often see chaos. We often see self-interest overtake community interest.
Well, yeah, again, yeah, this is, I mean, you know, I believe, it's, I guess, you know, it's... There is a terror of freedom. People can be scared of freedom. Some people find comfort in regimented lifestyle. Personally, I would rather have a little bit of chaos and yet have my freedom. To see, I value freedom. And I also believe that if in a free society, some people will be more successful than others. Some businesses will rise up, others will fail. And that's what the free market dynamics, how that works. But to my mind, it is far better if success or failure happens without vested interests being protected by political intervention. So, at least in a free society, if my house value drops, it's not because some politician passed a stupid rule, you know. If my house value goes up again, it's not because the politician passed some ridiculous rule. It's because of the nature of the market.
Well, let's take the environment, for example, yes. which is always, yes, especially in Hamilton with our river, yes, it's always a bit of an issue.
Yes.
Now, if we took away all the laws that we've put in place over the last 40 years to protect our environment, we would be back to square one.
Well,
we would have rubbish going to landfills.
Nah,
we would have waste going in the river. It's expedient for private enterprise. It doesn't.
No.
There's no cost levied.
I totally disagree with that. For starters, like again, we're not talking anarchy. We are talking about a rule of law. But what are those laws? What just laws are there? There would be common laws, okay, and boundaries, ownership, private property is a very good way of controlling waste and things like that. For example, if I live next to you, I can't have my rubbish blowing across onto your property. That gives you a legitimate case to take me to court, whatever. And there'd be mechanisms in place to... to people, you know, it's very tough to talk about these sorts of dynamic changes easily in a short period of time. But basically, I'm saying there would still be rules, and there would be, it would work better, I believe. If you actually look at like what's going on out there, the councils are polluting, and there's a hell of a lot of pollution going on the way the system is working, you know. So does the status quo actually work? I doubt that. Plus, there's a heck of a lot of... When people are Like, for example, it's tough. We teach a lot of green stuff in schools and stuff, but are the kids, are they actually caring about the environment, or are they throwing their rubbish out the windows of the car? I'm actually disputing the way that that we go about our whole thing. I don't think people actually, that the way we dictate the environmental things, I don't believe it goes into the heart. They don't take it in. So I, as a libertarian, I'm trying to create a, you know, I don't want to, it sounds a bit horrible, but I would like to see a society of free-willed people who run by personal ethics from their own inner integrity rather than because of a dictated law.
Now, this is interesting because I, being a pedestrian, I don't drive a car. I walk around the city. I see people every day throwing litter out the window.
Yeah.
How do we prevent that?
But because it's interesting. It certainly doesn't rules. And if you could pass a law and all of a sudden people stop doing things, well, gee, I'd be all for laws.
Well, I think the secret to that is not rules and fining. It's just campaign signs. Please do not litter. Be aware of what you're doing.
I think there's a place for that sort of thing. Yeah, you know, personally, you know, I think that's a good thing. I think that if people care about the society and about the environment, you shouldn't need the council to run a bureaucracy involved in that. The people themselves should voluntarily form a society or many little societies, and by doing this is how you engage society. I believe socialism disengages society because they expect the government to do everything, and they expect to, you know, a paid little crew of people to be doing it instead of being invested in it themselves. And like going to a church, you know, I mean, imagine if the government ran the churches, you know. Basically the way a church survives is, or fails, is the people have to want to join it, they have to belong to it, they have to want to finance it, and they actually invest themselves in it. And it's the same sort of thing with my ideas about how you go about community houses, art, sport, environmental issues. Is you've got to get the people to realise that if they want something, if that's their values, then they've got to invest themselves in it personally, not by force, not forcing everybody else, but by actually participating in the process, and that's, I believe, is what the core to libertarianism is. It's not a, you know, people think, oh, you get rid of the state schools, you get rid of state hospitals, blah blah blah. Oh, there's not going to be any schools and hospitals. It's not about that at all. It's about there being more variety of those. About the people getting engaged and doing it themselves. And then as far as the council goes, and this is a hard message to get across to people, why do I want to focus the part of keeping the council small and focusing on the core infrastructure, be it sewage disposal, water treatment, things like that? If they're not doing everything else, then they're less likely to make errors and grievous environmental disasters in respect to their infrastructure. Because if you're short on cash, you're not going to build those extra facilities. You're not going to upgrade your facilities as often as you should, because you've wasted money on stadiums, you've wasted money on other things. And that is a potential for environmental disaster. So this is part of about why libertarianism ought to make sense to most people. Yes, sure, you're not getting money given to you for your pet projects, but ultimately it focuses the council on what its core responsibilities should be.
Well, before we go to our first song, Tim, let's just have a look at the stadium for a second. There's a contentious issue. Well, it was, but look, it's become a very a community focal point. People are very proud of our Waikato Stadium.
People forget, but there's a disconnect there. People, they're proud of the stadium, but as soon as they get their rates bill, how proud of it. People keep disconnecting. When they go to the supermarket and they buy a loaf of bread and it's $5 a loaf, why is that? They don't realise when they've voted for a big government, big councils, that a large portion of those expenses and why they're struggling is because of the expenditure involved in such things.
I would dispute that, and I would say that the biggest cost, it's not taxation, it's not expenditure, it's interest bills.
There's obviously a lot of that too, but if you borrow money, what do you expect? I mean, interest is a fact of life. That the reason money becomes available for people to borrow money is because there's an interest factor. So interest is, again, in a free society, people will only enter into negotiations. If you're not willing to pay the interest, you're not going to enter into it. So if it's up to individuals to take responsibility for what interest rates they're prepared to pay or whatever. But I agree. I think sometimes interest rates can be extortionate, but again, you've just got to. That's just another massive subject to get into.
It is the economic systems,
but as a council man, all I'd be able to do is say, let's stop borrowing. So that's going to cut down the interest rates. Let's try and rein in our costs and try and pay off the debt. Try and stop money going towards things like interest, and just keep expense under control. Because to me, I care about people, and it worries me how people are struggling out there, And I would like to see the cost of just the basic things being as affordable as possible for people, Plus, there's the other side of the coin. If we keep our rates and things cheap, lower than, say, other areas, Auckland, Wellington, that means businesses get a little bit of an advantage here. And that means that there's going to be more employment here and less pain, basically. So there's a heck of a lot of reasons why, if keeping our council small and focused on what it's supposed to do, is logical,
Now, Tim, let's talk a little bit about yourself. Let's find out about you. When were you born?
1967 in Tokoroa.
Tokoroa, so you're a Waikato boy?
Originally, yeah, but travelled around a bit with my mother. But yeah, originally from Tokoroa, quite proud of that.
So where have you lived around New Zealand and overseas?
I've actually never even travelled overseas. I've never really had the urge to travel overseas. I guess I'm a little bit paranoid about some of the countries and some of the strange things that can happen over there. Plus, I got convicted for cannabis fairly young, and to be honest, I've just never bothered trying to get visas and things like that. So, I guess that's probably had something to do it as well.
You like a bit of cannabis?
Not so much these days, just simply because I'm a father and I'm busy. But I've certainly got nothing. I don't believe it should be illegal. I've spent quite a bit of time as an activist working to get it decriminalised.
It's an interesting situation we find ourselves. One of the issues, I think it's a non-issue, but some standing councillors have made it a big issue, and that's the synthetic pot issue. It's a kind of, again, we have this weird juxtaposition going on where we have this very, very strong substance that is only there because we don't allow the natural stuff to be legal.
True. Yeah, it's another big subject. I mean, it comes down to about rights, who owns your life, and it also comes down to, even if you look at pragmatic and expedience type situations, a prohibition doesn't work, All it does is make gangsters rich, and like you say, it has all these adverse side effects that the prohibitionists don't like to admit. And like you say, people are going to be taking drugs. It's interesting that these people seem to, well, a lot of them seem to forget that alcohol is a drug as well, you know. And sure, some of them people would think that they can would like to see alcohol get banned, but I mean, what does that tell you? They haven't learned nothing from the past or nothing about human nature as far as you know, people want to get high. And you know, as I think there's as many good things about alcohol as there are bad things. You know, people always try to focus on the negative, but I mean, when taken sensibly, it's great. It can be awesome, and so telling other people how to live their lives again. You know,
when we talk about narcotic substances, the word is always addiction, abuse. Oh, nobody ever talks about pleasure.
Exactly. I mean, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's your, you know, who are you living your life for? I believe it's your master of your own life. As long as you're paying your own way, paying for your own food and board, lodging, what you do with the rest of your life, as long as you're not harming other people, that's your business. And the pursuit, it's called the pursuit of happiness, is the best way to describe it. And what makes one person happy doesn't make other people happy.
So Tim, you were born in Tokoroa. You've moved around New Zealand with your mother. Yeah. Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I've got one sister. She's a customs officer over in Tauranga. And I have a brother who's an engineer in Auckland. And I have a couple of half-brothers. Who one is in Tauranga, running a produce warehouse, and a brother in Australia into computer stuff.
Well, you've got a smart family, because you yourself are an engineer.
Yeah, yes, that's right. I'm a fitter turner by trade, but done pretty much everything, and currently now a self-employed contract engineer, primarily working at Fonterra Tarapa. Fixing pumps and whatever, packing equipment.
Do pumps break down a lot?
They do. I mean,
we're talking huge volumes of milk,
aren't
we?
We are. We're talking 24/7, pumping hard out. And, that's just part of the laws of physics, you know. You've got friction going on, and you've got pressures and systems these days, especially like a big milk plant, they're getting more complex and more complex, and you've got a lot of computer control going on with valves and pumps and things. It's very difficult to get all that running smoothly, and so you know, if the smoother you can get it to run, the longer things would last. But just about everything is computerized now, and so you can imagine how many programs a massive plant, there'd be thousands of programs, and just a couple of guys writing the programs, and it becomes a mammoth task just to keep your head around all that. And I think they do a pretty good job, really, you know. And especially, technology's moving along, you know, equipment's become obsolete, new stuff comes along, you've got to try and keep up with the play. It's not easy. I think they do a pretty good job.
Now, you're a father yourself?
Yes, I've got two adult children with babies as well, so I'm a grandfather.
And really? You're just a young man.
Oh, I'm 45. My mother had me when she was 21. I had my daughter when I was 21, and she had her daughter when she was 21, so it's that's how it all rolled.
Do you enjoy being a father?
I love it. I've also got a three-year-old at home as well. So yeah.
So you're married or in a relationship?
Yes, no, I've been married since 2002, yeah. to a different lady to the, who are my older children too. But yeah, we've got a little boy called Roman. He's great. He's 3 years old and keeps me busy, you know.
45, that's a great age to be a dad, isn't it? Because you're a lot more mature, you're a lot more sure of yourself, you're much more emotionally in control of yourself.
Yeah, I'm loving it. It was a little bit unexpected, really, but it's been great. But he takes up a lot of my time, and it's been made it a little bit harder to do things like stand for council and things like that and expense, but you just got to roll with these things, and he's just wonderful, you know. He's just learning so fast, and yeah, just really great.
Now, let's talk about some of your interests. Of course, you're a churchgoer.
Well, I don't actually go to church. Because I'm a bit of a non-conformist.
Yes.
My particular type of Christianity, I wouldn't call it a denomination, so I'm a King James Bible believing dispensationalist, which means I believe that the King James Bible is trustworthy and authoritative. Plus, I also, as a dispensationalist, means I believe the Bible needs to be broken up into dispensations or ages, and it's laid out like a plan, and things change all the way through, and you've got to make sure you've, for example, today, we're not Jews, you know, we're under what looks called the dispensation of grace, which is St. Paul's gospel. And that's the gospel that most people know about, and that's that Christ died on the cross for our sins, and yet that is not the message that that Jesus preached. He preached the kingdom. He was about forming a kingdom in Israel, and you'll actually find that Moses said different things, and there was different things going on with Abraham, different things going on with Noah, and so you've got to appreciate each dispensation correctly, and that's how you solve a lot of these errors. For example, a lot of people who would say you couldn't be a libertarian, it's because they think you've got to impose the Old Testament law. And so that's a failure to distinguish the law from the age of grace we're in now. And so that's how you get confusion, is when people think you can just mishmash the Bible up and take any part of it.
So you're saying that humanity has changed and we can't apply... We can't apply the laws that worked in the time of Moses to today's society.
No, it's not that at all. I actually believe in universal ethics, so I don't believe ethics themselves have changed, or humanity. I believe Adam and Eve were just as human as I am, and I'm just a child of them. But the plan and program, it's like a progression. The Bible, things change as it goes through in different stages in God's plan. For example, so the Bible says one day that Jesus Christ will come back and he'll be ruling from Israel. Well, that'll be a different thing, see? And so then he'll be running a theocracy. And so my libertarianism, which is an aspect of you don't have to worship God, my God, you can make your own choices, that won't apply then. But so my libertarianism is based on the fact that God isn't ruling the world at the moment, and we're not trying to establish a God's kingdom on earth. That is going to happen at a future date, when Jesus comes back, you know. And so many people get confused about that, is they think that we're supposed to be trying to establish a theocracy, you know. And so that's what raised this question, is why don't I go to church? It's because so many people don't appreciate those distinctions, and so it's difficult to find a dispensational church.
Your worship is private and meditative.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And, that's right. I would love to fellowship with a church, but, again, I don't think it's right to go into a church that believes different things and subvert them over to my way of thinking, even though I believe that I would be doing them a service. But I just don't think that's honest and integrity, you know. So, yeah.
Now let's look at your activism. We've talked about legalization of, getting rid of prohibition.
Yeah.
What other things are you an activist? What other things are you involved in?
Maybe I spread myself a little bit too thin because I try to just about have a finger in all the pies, you know. I believe one of the big problems our country's going through is the Treaty of Waitangi apartheid situation. I'm a Maori myself, but I'm just flabbergasted at the what they call the treaty industry, you know, and the horrible racism that has grown up about it, around it, because it's official doctrine for the Maoris to feel as if they're victims, as if the Pākehā have robbed them and things like that. And I just think the whole thing is a dishonest rewrite of New Zealand history, because what happened in New Zealand isn't the same as what happened in Australia to the Aborigines. What happened in New Zealand isn't the same as what happened in America, but people tend to and the a lot of the activists and treaty separatists are trying to convince New Zealanders that there was a Holocaust perpetrated against the Maori people. You know, it was a completely colonisation of New Zealand was quite an amazing the British had learned a lot. New Zealand was one of the last countries to be colonised, and they learned a heck of a lot from their failings in America, failings in Australia, and things like that. It was a very the period in the early 1800s was a very benevolent period in England, where they had just freed the slaves and things like that, and the Treaty of Waitangi itself was such an amazing document, attempting to grant, you know, very primitive people equal British rights, you know, and that is quite a spectacular history, and New Zealand benefited from it. So I've spent a lot of time and effort as a Maori, a libertarian who understands these things. I feel morally obliged to speak up for equality before the law. I think I would like to have a colourblind one law for all people. I don't believe that's going to take anything away from Maori people, as a freedom and equality means that you can still love to do the haka. You can still learn to do your Maori carving, whatever cultural things you want to do. You're not going to be ruled against, you know. So freedom and equality works for everybody, you know.
Now, any historian who suggests that New Zealand wasn't a paradise before Pākehā arrived, that there was in fact wars and genocide and cannibalism, really has put his head on the block and will be shot down very
but
fast.
It was absolutely true, though. I liken the situation pre-European colonisation. It was almost like the mongrel mob versus the black power, and that because it was based on war, that the more powerful and violent you were, the more successful you were, and so it was really quite horrible. Like you said, cannibalism was commonplace, that one part of the reason that the chiefs of 1840 wanted to sign the treaty, they weren't forced to sign the treaty, they willingly signed it, was because of the advantages and great benefits that they could see from having the rule of law and the protection of the British Crown, you know. And it was a boon. It was a huge boon. The only people who tended not to benefit from it were, of course, the vested interests of the Maori hierarchy, who wanted to keep their power base going, of course. As the tribes assimilated more of the Western European ways, the tribalism started to fall apart, you know. And they didn't want that. They want to keep their power base, the people in charge, you know. That's the same political thing everywhere, you know.
But still, you know, there's no doubt that Maori have suffered a cultural dislocation. Now, for example, I was sitting on the city bus last night, the one that goes around the city for free.
Yep.
And there was a whole gaggle of schoolgirls, and one of them said, "Whereabouts do you live?" And she says, "I live very close to the hoary part of town." And she started going on about dirty hoaries and hoaries this and hoaries that, which was shocking because we were surrounded by Maori people in the bus, and she was talking in a very loud voice.
Yeah.
And I thought, my God, in this day and age, a young person speaking like that, what's she thinking? It horribly insulting to the people around her.
Yeah, it does sound insulting. One first thing, buses aren't free. Someone's got to pay for them. But number two is, that does sound terrible. Though, of course, you know, that just shows bad manners on her part. Though I'd like to suggest that there's many reasons why these places which have higher populations of poor who have Maori blood, there's a lot of reasons that these sorts of places end up forming. But having you know, first I'd like to say, if you were to actually go to if you were to look at photographs of just the average Maori living in the Waikato, say in the 1860s, man, oh man, the people living out in these areas, they live like kings compared to the hovels of what used to be the standard and normal lifestyle. They were honestly like mud huts. If you see some of the photos of what life was really like for Maori in the early days, it's worse than third world conditions.
There's a terrific little book written by a scientist at the Waikato University. I've forgotten his name and the book's name, but it was Life Along the Waipa River.
Yes.
Just as the Pākehā started arriving.
Yes.
And the descriptions from diaries, English diarists, were of impoverished people living in small groups, malnourished.
You got it.
And enslaved.
You got it. Yeah. It was real. That's how bad it was. So I'm not saying I am happy with the way that some of these people. I'm not happy with some of the bad statistics that Maori face today, but even at their worst, they are still 100 times better than they were back. That's how bad things were prior to colonisation and in the early days of colonisation, when the tribalism was still a factor. The more that Maori departed from that and went and got jobs and westernised, their standard of living shot up, you know. But I mean, we talk about these areas like that, and why do Maori have poor social statistics? And it's not because they are oppressed. It's a lot of it is to do with their own personal ethics that they've been that they've got, plus they've been taught that they're victims, you know. And so ending Waitangi separatism and getting rid of any political favoritism. If you look at socialism, the Maoris have been giving an extra handouts, right? Well, all that's done is make them extra dependent, extra. It hasn't, as the socialists expect, closed the gaps. It's made the gap keeps getting wider. And so the solution isn't the government. The solution is in their own hands. They have to step up one day and say, hey, I'm not a victim. I have to take responsibility for myself. If I want to be healthy, I can't just stuff my face full of pies. I've got to, in other words, it's about personal ethics. And they're not being taught these things. They're being taught that it's not their fault. They're being taught that they're victims, blah, blah, blah. It's a lot deeper than that. It's a heck of a lot deeper than that. But basically, all of the handouts, all of the victimisation. I'm a Maori myself, you know. I don't feel victimised. I feel blessed to live in this country, and
I think you're listening to Free FM 89.0. This is Deep with the Leaders. I'm Andrew, and I'm talking to.
They've all got Tim Pākehā blood in them
Tim
as well.
We're into the last session of this conversation. Let's talk briefly. We'll go through some issues. Fluoridation.
Yeah. I don't think that my personal opinion about the fluoridisation should have that much weight. Why I am in favour of it being removed is simply for two libertarian principles, which is, one, it's one less thing that the council can do, which I also believe that if anyone actually wants it in their water, that people could form an association and figure out means of dispensing it into their own systems.
Well, you can actually buy fluoride tablets.
There you go. That's what I'm saying. And then number two, I don't believe it's the duty of council to medicate the population, especially force medicate the population. Thus, so fluoride may in fact be good. I'm not saying it is, I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying that there's other principles involved. That's how I would roll with it. So I believe that it shouldn't be added.
It's a bit of a migraine headache for the city because we have a very, very strong anti-fluoride lobby. Even though in a referendum the city said, yes, we want fluoride, the lobby got that overturned, and we've had a tribunal, and now we're facing another referendum. If the city says, yes, we want fluoride, we'll get it back. But then again, we'll have this fight on our hands. It seems like it's never going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, technology is moving along. You know, now, like you say, you get fluoride pools, you get little dispensers that can dispense things into your own supply on your side of the line. Even, you know, I mean, another issue that's come up is the water meter issue. You know, that's not such a straightforward issue because it involves a heck of a lot of other things. For example, I believe now with modern filtration systems, people should be allowed to collect their own fresh water off their roofs and things like that, have tanks, and truck in their own water, you know, like, so I just believe there's a heck of a lot of modern things that technology now makes possible. People are just so used to going, no, let's all get fluoridated water and force everyone to have to use it, you know. So, as far as meters go, I think users should pay, but there's the issue that we're already paying for the water in our rates. So the thing you've got to ask is the council just grabbing more money? And it always seems to be that way.
Well, it is. When I was talking to Julie Hardacre, she was coming at it from a conservation point of view, and she was citing the example of Tauranga. Once they put water meters in, water usage dropped dramatically.
Yeah, well, that, you know, to me, this is, you know, it really gets up my nose, this sort of thing. Conservation of water. I'm not saying we should waste water, but if the government says, oh, we're going to supply you electricity, we're going to supply you water. Oh no, we haven't got enough water. Oh no, we haven't got enough electricity. Oh no, we haven't got enough roads. You know, and yet people always expect the government to be the solution of things. How many things does the government actually get right? Not a lot.
So you're saying that water usage should be a personal responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, if the council was sticking to its core functions, not wasting money on statues and on all sorts of other stuff, stadiums, well, maybe we'd have plenty of water.
Do you think we should sell our water supply? Did private enterprise make a better job of running it?
It's a difficult thing. Ultimately, yes, I do believe, but I don't, I wouldn't, it would have to be, you'd have to check how it all went about. And also all of the other legislation. For example, if there was legislation, and I do believe there is somewhere on the books, that says you can't have your own water tanks, you can't take water off your own roof and things like that, well, then that to me is would be just as unjust, because then you're forcing people to have to buy their water from a monopoly, you know. And so it's a big issues, big subjects, and it would have to depend on how it was deregulated. But ultimately, I'm a libertarian, yet I wouldn't mind paying a small amount of rates for my water, for the rubbish to be collected, and for the streets to be swept. I need those things done. And if the council was only doing those things, I don't even think I'd be running for council. I would be just doing other things. The reason I'm involved in politics is because council keeps trying to run our lives and ruin our lives by excessive rates and debts, you know.
Okay, now it surprised me. We've got these are issues. We have fluoride, we have the water, we have the airport, we have those have been, and the city debt, those have been the main issues. And it's surprised me that the CBD has been right off the agenda. Our CBD has passed, in my opinion, has passed its use-by date as a primary shopping centre. The only thing it lacks now, like all cities reaching the 200,000 mark, is a population, a residential urban population in high-rise apartment buildings. Every city in the world that goes that way, their central city comes back to life. These are the kind of issues I feel that this election we should be looking at, but nobody has thought about that. Have you had any thoughts about the CBD?
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember you stood on those particular issues a couple of years ago yourself, didn't you? Now, it's interesting because, of course, we know that Len Brown's Super City plan is exactly like that. I am I'm a member of a small group of people called the Affordable City group, and so we've got candidates in Auckland and Wellington and different places. I would be all for a high-rise buildings to go as long as it was free enterprise who were building these things, not special legislation and ratepayer money and all of that sort of thing going into it. In other words, I believe cities should be allowed to develop organically, which basically means they're not artificially created and dictated from a city plan.
But there is demand. There is demand already. Yeah, there's two things. You know, people are concerned that our urban city is encroaching way too much on our valuable farmland, and we want to concentrate the city and start growing it upwards. Yeah. There is great demand from people to live in apartments, well, but there is nothing there for them.
I don't know about, you know, like if there is a great demand, then an entrepreneur would take advantage of it. I don't believe there is such a great demand. Sure, the green philosophy is popular, and that with the Agenda 21 ideas of trying to conserve the environment, the natural environment outside the cities as much as possible. People are buying into all these ideas that you live in a high-rise building, you ride a public train, you don't have private transport and things like that. And I've got nothing against people choosing to adopt that voluntarily. I've got a big problem about council imposing that, in other words, restricting people's right to develop their properties on the boundaries, artificially causing housing crises so that people then start thinking, oh, well, I will move into this high rise because it's going to be cheaper. So this is social engineering at its most diabolical, as far as I'm concerned. I've got nothing against it happening organically, but I have a heck of a lot of a problem with it happening artificially because of the dictates of a council.
Now, Tim, we're rapidly running out of time, so here's my final question to you.
Yeah.
Tim, you get elected, you become mayor. You have 3 years, you do a good job, and you get three more years. The first part of the question is, are you capable of running a council? The second part of the question is, in 6 years' time, what's Hamilton going to be like?
It's a tough job. It would be a tough job. I'm going to give Julie Hardacre a bit of due credit. I think she hasn't done too bad a job, but what gets me about Julie is I believe she has been a good mayor because of forced circumstances rather than because of her own personal beliefs. And I hear that she wants to have a surplus by 2017. I don't know the full details about how she's going to achieve that, though that's good news, a lot better news than having no surplus, even though what that obviously, to me, I interpret that to mean that she still intends borrowing for the next 3 years. And so if I was not to become mayor, if I just became a city councillor, because I'm also standing in West Ward, I would try and encourage her to be even more frugal and try and achieve that goal.
Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in the studio. This is the last of our series In Deep With The Leaders. We'll be returning next week.
For more episodes of this Community Access Radio show, please visit freefm.org.nz. Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this podcast possible through funding the Access Internet Radio Project.